If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey guys, welcome to And the Writer Is. I'm your host, Ross Golan. I've written with hundreds of artists and writers over the years, and my favorite part of each session is the first hour when we catch up about life, the industry, politics, composition, whatever. So this is a journey of learning why people write songs, how people write songs, and most importantly, who the people are who write the songs. I'm producing this with the great Joe London, Big Deal Music Publishing, and Mega House Music Management. If you want to listen to the songs we discuss in this podcast, follow us on our socials, find out about special live events, or buy that merch, aka that hat I always wear, go to our website, www.andthewriteris.com. For a little bit of context, we just wanted you to know that a lot of these were recorded before quarantine. And as we know, a lot has changed in 2020. So again, please stay safe out there and enjoy the new episodes of And the Writer Is. Welcome to And the Writer Is. I am your host, Ross Golan. Today's legend is one of the most iconic guitarists and best-selling artists of all time. This Grammy winner is part of the elite era of rock and roll. His career spanning 20 solo albums included one that stayed at the top of the Billboard 200 for 10 weeks and stayed on the chart for 97 total. His discography helped define the 60s, 70s, and 80s. And after a smash cover of Baby, I Love Your Way in the 90s and a Grammy in the aughts, he's now, as of this week, adding a page-turning memoir to his illustrious resume. In his book, aptly named Do You Feel Like I Do?, he shares some of the most riveting stories of success and heartache in the music industry that I've ever read. All the way from Kent, England, this savant-turned-rock star can make his guitar speak literally. And the writer is the one and only Peter Frampton.
Hello.
Hi. This is awesome, man. Welcome. Clutch.
Nice to be with you today.
So, yeah, so, you know, I always want to know how people actually figured out they wanted to be a songwriter. And I know a lot of this with someone like your career, it's written down in many different places. But just from your mouth, you know, tell me about, you know, you were born. You happen to be born in this, like, in an era and in a country and in a time where people seem to really like guitar players. So, you know, tell me a little bit about it. What was it like being, you know, growing up in Kent, England?
Well, I was born, it's going to be a long interview. I was born, 5 years after, well, 4 years after the Pacific War ended, but 5 years after the European War ended. So I think my parents and a lot of parents at that time were just thrilled to have made it through. A lot didn't, obviously. And so when the baby boom started, when they got home from war, I think at that point, a lot of parents sort of forgot their upbringing because they'd just been through hell. And and some had got through it, a lot didn't. And so I think any vestige of Victorian lifestyle that my parents grew up in completely disappeared straight away. And it was a completely different, I think the values of what was proper and what wasn't changed at that point. And obviously there was a big reason for this. And when children of the baby boomer children, when they showed any signs of creativity, I think it was championed and it was a more open society at that point. That wasn't people saying, well, actors, that's a terrible career, or, you know, or musician, you don't want to be a music. You know, now it was, we had Elvis, 1955, Elvis comes through, and all these great American artists like Buddy Holly, Eddie Cochran, people like that were coming over to see us, well, not Elvis, but coming over to see us in Europe, and we got the bug really early. And so for me, by the time I was eight, I wanted a guitar, and I just didn't want an acoustic guitar, not the one on your, by your left shoulder. I wanted the one on by your right shoulder. No, I wanted the one right behind you, the Strat.
That one. Yeah, exactly.
I mean, yes.
What kind of music did your parents listen to? What's interesting about that era is that there really is this, you know, jazz is really in its heyday, and then you have this new kind of sound. I imagine that there's still some sort of generational gap, or were your parents more, were they more excited about new music coming from the U.S., or were they more traditionalists?
Well, they started off being traditionalists. My father did. My mother's always been, was always very open to new music and new stuff, and she was very, very, very into that. And but I think that it was their music was big band music, American big band music. My mother was in the audience, waiting for Glenn Miller to arrive. In Paris when his plane crashed that day.
Wow.
And Glenn Miller, the huge band leader, when he went into the ocean, unfortunately, and his band were already on the stage. So, I mean, that was the era. And but my parents' favorite music together was the Hot Club de France, which was Django Reinhardt, Stefan Grappelli, Django's brother, and a piano player and a bass player, basically, you know. And I hated it. It sounded like, as my kids would call it when they first started hearing me play, it was, Dad's listening to that old movie music again. So,
I bet when Midnight in Paris came out, they were like, "Oh wow, this is Dad's music," because that was a good moment where we actually got to hear some. You know, there have been a few times where Django's. Obviously, I know there are a bunch of biopics about him and whatnot, but
yes,
that's really interesting. Did you emulate, you know, were you trying to once you got a guitar, were you trying to emulate any specific guitarists? Were you trying,
yes.
Were you forced to emulate those?
No.
Gypsy jazz guitarists, or were you on, you know, in your bedroom just doing the
I was in my bedroom or in the living room with the record player. I was trying to emulate Hank Marvin from the Shadows, our instrumental band that backed up Cliff Richard. And but I would play my Shadows album. This was probably when 62, maybe 61, 62. And I was 11, 12, and I would play that. I would leave the room, and Dad would say, "Are you done?" And then he would put on the Django Reinhardt, Hot Club de France. And I couldn't get up the stairs quick enough. This was just awful stuff to me. It sounded like old, horrible music. So anyway, and then about the third time I was running up the stairs, I stopped halfway and I heard this incredible guitar run that Django did. And I went, wait a second, this guy's pretty good. So it just wasn't electric. That's what it was. I think I wanted an electric plug-in, gadgets, amp, you know, wires. I wanted to be like the Shadows, you know. And so then I would stay in the room. So it became a two-album deal. It became, I would play the Shadows, Dad would play Django, and we'd both enjoy each, you know. So that was my musical basis, and big band American music and blues, of course.
Do you remember the run that Django did?
Well, there's quite a few of them. I know that Minor Swing is a very early track, which he did many times. This runs all over the place.
Did you play over his records? I mean, is that how, I mean, or not his, but you know, you were saying the Shadows, are you learning their exact solos?
Yes.
You know, lick for lick, or are you actually starting to create your own melodies as you go?
Well, I would copy Hank Marvin. I couldn't copy Django yet. I wasn't quite that adept. And maybe one day. So I would copy Hank's playing to the T. You know, I didn't have a Strat. I had a Hofner Club 60, which was a great guitar, but it wasn't a Fender. And I don't live in New York, but you can probably hear there's a siren going by. I probably want to stop for a second.
It's like just loud enough.
Yeah.
My wife always makes fun of me because I'll hear anything. If we're, you know, five rooms away, it's like, the frequency of the refrigerator is driving me nuts whenever.
You're like me. But anyway, where were we?
Well, you were saying how you...
Oh, yeah. So I remember.
So, Fender, you weren't in New York. Oh, no. The New York was... But I guess you could argue the instrumentation too, but go for it.
Yeah, so I would learn Hank Marvin licks, the whole album, all the singles, the B-sides, everything, note for note. But then very early on, I would start writing my own instrumentals, like The Shadows or like The American Ventures, which some people might now draw a connection there. But... Yes, so I started writing songs very early, and I got a reel-to-reel tape recorder. I mean, the quality was disgusting, but it was something. And I would put down the rhythm part, and then I would be able to play over the top the lead part, you know. So, and then I got two tape machines when I'm still only about 12 or 13, and realized that I could go sound on sound. So I could go record the rhythm on one tape machine, put the microphone of the second machine in between the speaker of the first one and my guitar, and now I can pick up the rhythm here and me playing the lead. You know, so it was very basic overdubbing at that age.
But who's even bringing that? I mean... Somebody along the way says, well, you can go buy a tape recorder or can show you that. Or was it just something that you intuitively knew, I need to record this guitar playing? I knew a lot of kids that could really play guitar, but never understood that you could record the guitar. Those are different things.
Yes. This is the techie side of me that came through because I think I was maybe at school. I had seen a teacher play something back from a tape recorder, and a Grundig, I think, was the one I used to use. And I thought, and then she would tape people talking and stuff like that. I thought, wow, I could record my guitar. I've got to get one. So that's when I got a secondhand tape recorder. And then I got the second one and went, sound on sound, and then I needed echo, so I wired the bathroom as an echo chamber, which was very discouraging for those who needed to use the bathroom in the house. You know,
I'm thinking your parents must have thought this was either brilliant or just a nuisance. But
they didn't quite understand what the hell I was doing. But then when I played them the result, I would send my guitar sound through a little amplifier. I don't know how I did this in those days, but I did. I sent it through to a little speaker that I took off the kitchen wall that my dad used for an extension for the radio. And I took that upstairs and I put that in the bath. And then on the windowsill of the bathroom, I put the microphone for the tape recorder. And then it would come back into the tape machine, and I would play. My guitar sound would go through the bathroom, picked up on the other microphone, come back, and I actually had a echo return level on the second machine.
Amazing.
That's me. I'm just this. So I can say I was a recording engineer in preparation anyway when I was about, 10 or 11, 12 years old.
What inspired you to sing at all? Like to be as a writer, you're writing, there's one thing where you're getting inspired by the technological side, the guitar playing side, but there's a voice somewhere that's saying that you need to actually write songs. Those are different.
Yes. Well, I think after I got the guitar going, I then said, well, I should learn to play the piano. So my parents bought me this old heavy upright, which I remember it took like four beefy men to bring it up the stairs to my bedroom. And I was worried it was going to go through the ceiling in the kitchen. So I taught myself piano and I'm a very basic, octave in the left hand and chords and a few notes in the right. Not a piano player, but I know enough to write songs. And I learned, the way I learned to play the piano was finding chords. And while I was doing that, I was singing a melody over the top of it. So I started singing, and I never wanted to be the lead singer in a band. I just wanted to be the guy that does the ooh shooby doo wah, in the background and play lead guitar, But, you can sing. You sing my song here. I'm written here on piano. So, and when I joined the Herd, I was the guitar player, shooby doo wah singer. And not much else. I think I maybe sang one song a night. The other singers in the band were the lead singers.
Who's convincing you that it's time to go and do, I know that we have limited time, so we'll jump forward. We're now in the mid-60s, late-60s, and somebody's saying you should go and do, it's time for you to do your own music. On your own. And it feels like that's an era where a lot of bands, there was sort of a mix. There were bands and then there were real guitarists. But that's a big leap to go and pursue that. Why go and do a solo album when you can be the shooby-doo-wop guy? Why would you put yourself in front of all those people?
Because I realized that I needed to be in control of my own destiny. And at this point, I decided that I would do, I decided to leave Humble Pie just before their biggest album came out, which I was on at that point, Rockin' the Fillmore, the live album. And I thought it was a better time to leave before it came out because we all knew it would be relatively successful. But not as big as it was. And so, of course, I thought I'd made the biggest mistake of my life, but I was determined that it's time for me now. I'm coming into my own. I want to lead my own situation. And it was an easy decision for me to make, but I was sad about it because, of the guys in Humble Pie. But I did decide to leave and make my own, at least for this first album, I was going to do all the singing. I didn't plan on doing it for the rest of my career. But, do what you do and things will happen. So in the end, I ended up singing everything, So I'm not the world's greatest singer by any means. What I have, I can deal with pretty well. I use it to its fullest ability, my fullest ability. But guitar playing still my forte or my biggest love. I really enjoy singing, but like I say, if Paul Rodgers is around, I'd much prefer he be singing.
I always think that what's interesting in a story is what happens between the hits and when you leave a band to pursue being a soloist and then they have their biggest hit, but you haven't released yet Wind of Change.
Right.
Did you ever call them and say, can I come back?
No.
Or were you so sure that it was, or were they like, this is done? I mean, that's a...
It's an interesting question. It's something about my resilience, in as much as I make huge decisions really easy, really easily. And the small things in life that really are annoying, really annoy me. And my kids say that, Dad, calm down, you know. It doesn't matter that you moved the magazine from that side. I know it's supposed, you think it's supposed to be in the middle, or that part is in the wrong place. You shouldn't move that. That's, you know, those little, I'll go crazy about that. And I'm trying to think of other little stupid things. But when it comes to leaving a band or, you know, becoming an American citizen, two huge things for me. Both of those were. And it becomes very easy for me because I've made my mind up. It's one of those things.
Between Wind of Change, which is obviously a successful album, going into Frampton Comes Alive, there's 4 years of probably touring and dealing with the success of that album.
Mm-hmm.
This is... The 70s is... an era where it feels like there aren't many times in the 80s and 90s that I can think of where live albums and the live show is so intertwined with the success of an artist.
Mm-hmm.
When you released Frampton Comes Alive, was that supposed to be for your fans, or was the assumption that this was going to up, you know, there's being successful, and then there's that album, you know.
Mm-hmm.
When you released that, was the goal for that album to supersede what you had done previously, or was it to sort of just be a live album that you did? You know, there's a difference in expectations.
Yes. It really wasn't any of that. It was, I had left Humble Pie, having been a big part of mixing with Eddie Kramer, the A Rock in the Fillmore, Humble Pie gold album. And Humble Pie had 4 albums before that, which did relatively little sales. And we just felt at that particular time, Humble Pie's studio album before that is the favorite one, studio one that I'm on, called Rock On. Our audience was really building, and we felt that from that album we should definitely give them the live stage act, because that's what people were coming to see. That's what they liked about Humble Pie. So it was pretty much a foregone conclusion when my 4th solo album, Frampton, was sort of on a par. I felt it was my best studio album, like I felt that Rock On was. I'd reached a level where I felt I was writing really well, and the band was sounding great, and the album was very well received in comparison to all the others beforehand, and had sold a good amount, more than the others put together, 300,000 before Frampton Comes Alive came out. So we knew if we just followed, or I don't think anybody actually said the word, let's do a live album. We just all went, uh-huh. You know, it was the assumption that if we follow the same game plan as Humble Pie, maybe this one will be a gold album.
When you do this live recording, and I imagine a lot of the people who listen to this have heard it, but one of the things that you became famous for during that was this ability to do the voice box live.
Mm-hmm.
And explain why you started doing that. It's a unique sound. It's a unique instrument. What was it that... to me, it looks like you were just having fun and were just mm-hmm. in the air of, yeah, let's just... This is a cool way to make a guitar work. You know, I mean, I don't really understand how it works. I just have seen videos mm-hmm. of you doing it. Mm-hmm. So can you explain what a voice box is and why you feel the need to be still innovating your instrument?
It goes way back to when I would listen to a radio show from Luxembourg called Radio Luxembourg in Europe. From 7 p.m. till 11 p.m., at least weeknights, I think, they played. We had the BBC radio, which was awful. You hardly ever heard any good music at all, especially no blues, no rock, no, you know, American music. So, but Radio Luxembourg would have, I think he was a Canadian DJ, would play all American music, and we couldn't get enough of it. Well, their call sign was 208, Fabulous 208, that's what it was. Because there was a magazine they put out as well called Fabulous 208. So, but they would do the call sign, as a lot of American stations used to use, this special gadget that you put on your throat, and it made it sound like a computer voice, and it was Fabulous 208, that sort of talk-boxy sound, you know? And when the first time I heard that, I went berserk. I thought, oh, my God. God, what is that? How did they do that? Well, let's fast forward to I'm in the studio with George Harrison, and we're doing the All Things Must Pass album. And we're laying down, I'm there for about a week, laying down the acoustics with George and Badfinger, the three members of Badfinger, me and George, all sitting in a line. And George says, well, tomorrow I've got Pete Drake coming in from Nashville. And he's a great pedal steel player. Bob Dylan told me about him. So anyway, Pete Drake was one of the A-team. He was like, you name it, country song in the 60s, he's on it. It's phenomenal player. So I get to meet Pete Drake. He sets up his pedal steel the following day. Like, my feet can touch, I'm so close, my feet can touch the legs of the pedal steel. And he says, in a slow moment, he just says to me, Peter, would you like to hear something different? I said, oh, yeah, yeah. So they're changing reels or something. So he gets out this little box, puts it on the edge of his pedal steel, two-neck pedal steel, double neck, and then he starts plugging stuff in here, plugging stuff in there. Then he gets a plastic tube out of somewhere. It's like that Bob Dylan thing. Then you stick it in your mouth and you smoke it. You know, it's like... he puts this plastic pipe on the box, and then the other end of it goes in his mouth, and he says, listen. And he starts playing the pedal steel, and it starts singing to me out of his mouth with that sound. And I think every hair on my body stood. I stood up and screamed, there it is, there it is, you know. And then George heard what was going on. And there's actually, that moment is on YouTube, audio. The audio of that moment, I couldn't believe it. But it's George laughing, George talking and me laughing when Pete does this first thing.
Oh man, legendary. When Frampton Comes Alive comes out, you have it's just sort of this nonstop hit after hit moment, not to mention that the album is just ubiquitous and becomes part of the conversation for how rock and roll, certainly how live albums should be recorded. Do you start thinking it's easy to write hit songs? Do you start having, you know, when you have one hit and then you have a follow-up and another one and your album's constantly on the charts, you know, one of the things in your book that's really interesting is you talk about drug use and your relationship with your manager and whatnot. And I imagine that, I imagine that this whole era is confusing.
Mm-hmm.
Just describe what it's like to have the album of, you know, nominated album of the year, you know, all these singles. Are you starting to think this is just normal? Is humans aren't supposed to know what it feels like.
I did start to get used to that fact, but also at the same time, doesn't give me a feeling of well-being, because I have now released the album that was in 76 the biggest album ever, biggest selling album in America ever, and it had taken me 6 years. A Humble Pie album, there's a song off Rock On. There's numbers off 4 other solo records. So I cherry-picked from my past and a Stones number. And so I knew that I'm not as prolific a writer as I would like to be. I take my time to come up with the real good ones. And so now everyone's talking within a few months of Comes Alive coming out and being at number one and being the number one selling record of all time. And they're starting to talk to me about doing another one straight away. And I said to everybody, it took me 6 years to write this material. Go away, you know. And then the pressure. So when I was number one and heard about it for the first time, the album, I was elated. I was feeling on top of the world. When I got the call, it was the number one selling record of all time. I got scared because I knew that it would take me longer than they were going to give me to come out with the next album. And that was the beginning of my downfall, basically.
You view it as a downfall?
After I'm In You and Sgt. Pepper, yep, I'd call that a downfall.
I guess some of it is that it's this whole thing about expectation, you know, is because, you know, when at least I grew up in the 80s, so your name was always still part of the conversation that, you know, people still listen to these albums. So it never felt like a downfall. How would you define a downfall?
I can't even remember whether, Sgt. Pepper was first or I'm In You was first, but those two kind of, came out, and one was humiliating, which was the film,
right?
Because it was so awful. And I'm In You was a disappointment because it wasn't as good as I knew I could do if I had more time. And I think that's the biggest mistake I made by not saying to everybody at that particular time, not ready, go away, give me some time. And I didn't do that. And so I take responsibility for my mistakes of letting them talk me into doing something that I wasn't ready to do.
One thing that I'm curious about is, you know, that I'm In You comes out in 1977, is a big hit. And after that, you know, in the 80s and 90s, it feels like your songs are being covered all over the place. I mean, one of the cool anecdotes is that one of the first songs U2 ever performed as a group, you know, is Show Me the Way I don't know if you've ever heard that, but in a high school talent show. You know, which is one thing when it's U2 and their talent show, and then it's another thing when you hear one of the biggest covers, I feel like, of my lifetime, at least, with Baby, I Love Your Way, with Big Mountain.
Mm-hmm.
Did that, I imagine when you're feeling like you're on a downfall, that when you hear these bands covering your music, it's got to feel good to be part of the zeitgeist, even, you know, past that, right?
I had, when touring, due to Frampton Comes Alive, when touring on that record, during that record's period of success, we went to Ireland, and we were in the hotel. I'm not sure what city we were in, and the waitress came up, and she knew who we were, and she said, I went to school with you too. And I said, oh, wow, really? She said, yeah. She said, and they would play Show Me the Way at school. You know, I said, no way. She said, absolutely. So I flash forward to when I'm living in possibly the early 2000s. I'm living in Cincinnati, and Bono comes to town, and I'm part of, I get invited because he's come to see these houses that they have built from his one organization for AIDS patients and homeless and all sorts of stuff. But I mean, it was just wonderful. And he came there to congratulate everybody. And so I got introduced to him there, and then he quickly took me aside and we sort of hid from everybody else. And he was just like wanting to talk, you know. And I said, well, I've got to ask you a question, man. And he said, I've heard that you guys used to do Show Me the Way. And he said, we did. And I said, wow, that's incredible. I said, I'm so honored. He said, I always thought of it as a prayer. And I thought that sort of sums up how differently people think of songs and what the lyrics really mean. Mine was a love song to a lady, Show Me the Way, and the way he read it was a prayer.
Wow.
You know, which was so cool that I love that people take different meanings and that I covered that for him. But anyway, then I very recently saw that I was, he wrote me a note because Show Me the Way was one of his 50 favorite songs or 60, whatever it was. And so I thanked him on the internet. I've forgotten the next part of the question, but that's my Bono story.
There's a quote that has been attributed to you that says, very early on, I learned that you can have a great band, you can have a great producer, a great studio, everything can be right, but if you don't have great songs, you've got nothing. Can you elaborate for our listeners, you know, the value of a song to you, especially being a guitarist?
Yes. Well, the way I know that a song is good is if my MO for writing now is to not turn anything electronic on unless it's my guitar amplifier. But no door, no drum machine, no nothing. Just pick up an acoustic, an electric, or sit down at the piano. And if you can play, say you come up with three, but you really like this second one you did, and you want to get a reaction from someone you really respect, and you can play it live on the keyboard or on the acoustic or on electric, and they like it, then, and you know it's a good song. It stands alone bare like that. But, and then you can orchestrate it or put the band in or, you know, however you want to record that song. Big Mountain doing a reggae version of Baby I Love You Way. That wasn't the way it was written, you know, but what a terrific idea. You know, what a great record that is, you know. So, it's all down to knowing that if I sit down and play you an acoustic and voice a brand new song, I know it's good. And it'll stand up just with a voice and one instrument.
You won a Grammy in the aughts, the 2000s. For doing music that isn't rock and roll. I mean, it's similar, but different.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. To get that kind of appreciation later, how does that feel emotionally when we've talked about how you felt that after the mid-70s that you had a downfall? Mm-hmm. How does it feel to be winning Grammys in the 2000s?
I like the S you put on that. the Grammys. That, I'm waiting for that next one.
Fair enough.
No.
We're not young yet.
Thank you.
When we do that album, there you go.
Well, I had this idea all along that one day I would do an instrumental album, just like The Shadows, and that's who started me off. And but I had a lot of different musical inspirations to cover, from rock to jazz to gypsy jazz, R&B, kind of Spanish, South American feel, everything. I covered a lot of different ground on Fingerprints. And I think it wasn't obviously done for financial gain. nothing I've ever done has been for financial gain. It's always been because I've wanted to do it and enjoyed doing it most of the time. And then I get nominated for the Grammy and I couldn't believe it. And then I said, well, we'll go, but I'm not going to get it, you know. And I was nominated for the song, Black Hole Sun, the version, Soundgarden, wonderful song of Chris's. And I didn't get that. But the very first award they read out for album, instrumental album of the year, was me. And I froze. I almost couldn't get out of my chair because I was so overcome with a feeling of accomplishment that I've broken the mold of people thinking of me in old terms. You know, now I started off the guitar player and now I'm ending up the guitar player, which is where I've always wanted to be.
In this final segment, because I know we're running out of time, this is our five for five. I'll just name five things, and you can just sort of tell me what comes off the top of your head.
Okay.
This will be a way for us to tell some of your story along the way. But let's start with David Bowie.
Sorry, say that one more time.
David Bowie. Like, just tell me what comes off the top of your head about these people, or a little anecdote is nice.
Okay. Dave Jones, David Bowie, my dearest friend for many, many, many years, his entire life, from when he was 14 or 15, I met him at school. And he was kind of like an older brother. He was always there to call. We did not always see each other for long periods, but when we did, it was like we'd just seen each other yesterday. And he always looked after me. In fact, he was, I needed a sax player for one of the tracks, the opening tracks on Fingerprints. And I knew Dave plays sax. And so that's how I first saw him, playing sax on the school steps, you know, with the Conrads. And so I said, he's got to know the cutting edge sax player. So I called him and he said, yeah, Courtney Pine, you got to get Courtney Pine from England. He'll be the one you'll need. So I did. And it was phenomenal. You know, what a great player. And so Dave was always helping me along the way.
Amazing. Bob Mayo.
Oh, Bob Mayo. Miss him so much. My musical brother through a torrential time. we had so much fun playing music together and we never spoke about it. I know that seems weird. It's just something that simpatico musically. And he would even change what he was playing behind my solos to be an even more supporting, give me an even more supporting chord, or taking it out of the box a little bit, and he would take me somewhere else. So it was a partnership on stage musically, and he was truly one of the nicest, caring people I've ever known.
Let's talk about your memoir. So your memoir will be number three.
Always thought I might do one. Then every time someone said, well, what do you think? No, I don't think Nazareth. No, No. And then, unfortunately, I got diagnosed with a muscle disease, IBM, inclusion body myositis. And it slowly, you lose the use of muscles in your legs and your arms. So mine is incredibly slow moving, so I'm very lucky. But we decided that because it was in a progressive stage and I'd fallen on stage a couple of times, that now was the time to not do another tour, but to do the farewell tour. And I could make it as long as I could play, but so I could get around the world and say goodbye to everybody, you know. But we only got as far as, I mean, remarkably, we got it finished in October of 2019.
Amazing.
And that was, we were planning on going to Europe in May. And then other countries after that. So we had to stop, obviously. But at the same time, I thought, well, it's probably, if I'm going to do a book, this probably is the right time, you know. And I had no idea how difficult it is and how painful it can be, or how enjoyable it can be. It depends what you're recounting. And I took myself through the journey with the help of Alan Light, wonderful writer, my co-host in the book, and he really helped me and guided me through how to do this. And I was dreading it coming out because it's very personal. Otherwise, why do it?
Right.
And this is not just a bunch of songs coming out with a few hidden meanings. This is it in black and white, you know. And so I was really worried about it coming out, but I'm starting to calm down now because I'm getting, people are seemingly liking it, and I'm so thrilled.
Yeah, the feedback is amazing.
It really is. I'm bewildered, but very thankful and honored that people like it.
It's interesting thinking of the word feedback, considering your guitar playing history, and that's what you aim for, you know, is to control your feedback when you play guitar and then also when you write a memoir.
Yeah, I can't control my feedback when I write, but I can in music. Yeah, I get you.
All right, I'm going to lump the last two with these three, Julian, Jade, and Mia, your kids.
Oh. Well, and Tiff, my stepdaughter, Tiffany. And so they mean the world to me. It's been a journey because a touring musician doesn't have a lot of time to spend with family, which is the downside of it. But I am very, very lucky that I have a terrific relationship with all my children, and I'm actually going up to New York mid-November, if I'm allowed to, and see my granddaughter for the very first time. She was born in April, L, like the magazine, and I have seen her 2 to 3 times a day on Zoom and FaceTime. I wish I could reach through the screen and just pull her through or pull me through. But I'm actually going to go up there and spend 5 days with them.
I love that. Well, thank you so much for doing this. I could go and ask a million questions when it comes to how you recorded your albums, and we can always talk about songwriting and the music industry. I mean, the music industry is so different from the 60s and 70s, but what you guys were doing was really defining an industry that were, you know, it was a young industry. You mentioned Elvis, and that's really the beginning of what we know of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, the modern music industry, and you've been a staple in so much of it. So I really appreciate you coming on and being, you know, as honest and you know, being a participant in this conversation with the thousands of people we have that listen to this every week. So
Well, thank you. And I have the next album when it comes out, hopefully late spring. Maybe I can come back and we can go into detail on that.
It's an open invitation, my friend. Thank you so much for doing this. And we'll see you in the spring when your album.
Yes. All righty. All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Thanks for listening to this episode of And the Writer Is. If you want to hear music from this songwriter I just interviewed, be sure to check out our Spotify playlist or visit our website at andthewriteris.com. If you like what we're doing, please subscribe to us. You can also like us on Facebook and Twitter. And the Writer is produced by Joe London, edited by Miles Bergsma, and published by Big Deal Music. A special thanks to David Silberstein from Mega House Music and Michael White. Until next time, this is Ross Golan.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.